Off play action. Going for it all into the end zone, and it is caught. Alshon Jeffrey for the touchdown.
And Nick Foles told us, he said, early in this game, I want to be able to take my shot.
Blunt is in the backfield with Garrett Blunt. Swings to the outside, inside the 10. Blunt to the end zone behind a Celek block. His 11th career postseason TD. Big hole left side, James White. Inside the 10, takes it to the end zone. Touchdown, Patriots. And they're going to snap it. And it's Trey Burton who throws caught. Foles, touchdown.
Here we go. They've got all these signals. Shotgun, he would not have been eligible, but for the fact he was in the shotgun, not under center. And there's the old basketball player.
Four-man rush, and then it's caught. Gronkowski for the touchdown. The pass into the end zone, and it is Corey Clement. Yes, touchdown.
How many times, Al, do we come into the Super Bowl and we say, who is it? Who's the unknown?
Play fake on first down. To the end zone, caught. Touchdown, Hogan. And Brady lost one for Gronkowski, reaching for it. Touchdown. They look unstoppable right now from the 12.
Zach Ertz out wide, one-on-one.
Clement flares out to the right, caught over the middle, and into the end zone. Zach Ertz for the touchdown. And again, all you can think back to now is the Jesse James play with Pittsburgh. Does he complete the process?
The receiver possesses the football, becomes a runner, breaks the plane of the goal line. The ruling is confirmed. It is a touchdown.
Uh-oh. Brady gets hit. The ball is out. And Philadelphia has it. Derek Barnett comes away with it.
Pays huge dividends with the first sack fumble of the game.
Brady under pressure. Escapes the sack. Launching one for the end zone. It's a jump ball and it's incomplete. And Gronk was there. And time runs out. And for the Philadelphia Eagles, the long drought is over.
I felt good. I mean, you never really know what it's going to be like when you're going to a Super Bowl. I've never been here before. So there are normal nerves. You got butterflies. I mean, it's a big game. I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than this. So, but I felt good. I felt calm. I think the big thing that helped me was knowing that I didn't have to be Superman. I have amazing teammates, amazing coaches around me, and all I had to do was just go play as hard as I could and play for one another, play for those guys, you know, not look at the scoreboard, not look at the time, just go out there and play. Don't worry about it. That was something we've been working on, and Doug and I were talking. I was like, let's just run it. It was a good time. The end was a little wider than I thought, so I was like, I really need to sell like I'm not doing anything. It worked. Trey made an amazing throw right on the money. I just looked it in. We've repped it for a while, so I was excited to get it run and in the Super Bowl.
You know, I trust my instincts. I trust everything that I'm doing, and I want to maintain that aggressiveness with the guys. In games like this against a great opponent, you got to make those tough decisions that way and keep yourself aggressive. Yeah, I'm so happy for Nick. A lot like this football team, a lot of people counted him out and didn't think he could get it done, and I believed in him, the staff believed in him, the players believed in him. You know, this whole postseason, Nick has shown exactly who he is and what he can do and what he's capable of doing. He's well-deserved of the honor.
It wasn't quite enough. Obviously, didn't do a good enough job coaching, missed a lot of opportunities offensively in the first half, didn't play good enough defense. Just wasn't quite enough against a good team like Philadelphia. Just couldn't quite make enough plays to come out on top tonight. It's disappointing.
I'd obviously love to not have it stripped from me. I was just holding the ball, trying to get it downfield, and those guys had a good rush and got in there and made a good play. It's tough to lose these games, I mean, but again, you can't win the game if you're not in the game, and you play to win, and sometimes you lose. I'm disappointed. Wish we could have done a better job. I expect to be back, so we'll see. I mean, it's 15 minutes after the game ended. I'd like to process this a little bit, and I wouldn't see why I wouldn't be back.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
You know what? We like to call this broadcast the extravaganza every afternoon from 3 to 5 p.m., but last night was an offensive extravaganza. Super Bowl 52 setting all kinds of records. Some people call it an epic game. Some people are calling it one of the greatest ever. I am calling it simply an offensive extravaganza. It was not a complete football game. neither by the winner nor the loser, and that part of it made it much, much less enjoyable than it probably would have been. Welcome to our extravaganza right here at 12 minutes after 3 o'clock on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket, where we are Toledo's sports leader, and that is one of the many elements we're going to be discussing on what is almost going to be exclusively Super Bowl reaction and discussion today, and also maybe a little bit on the aftermath of the championship game last night, meaning what does the future hold for the likes of Nick Foles, whether or not Rob Gronkowski is really thinking about retirement, or was that heat of the moment last night after taking that tough loss in Super Bowl 52. How many more years does the MVP, Tom Brady, have in him, considering he just did this at 40? There are so many things to discuss about that. We will get into a little bit of college hoops with Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes, but that's not until 4:40. For now, we are all in on Super Bowl 52 and its ramifications. Want your thoughts at 866-240-1065. First, we want to say good afternoon to Ryan Van Bibber, who joins us once again from SB Nation, NFL writer for SBNation.com. And, Ryan, thanks for the time. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me today.
Do you get any less enjoyment from a football game when it appears that neither defense shows? I mean, and here, follow what I'm saying here. I think if we would have had 9-6 yesterday, nobody would have appreciated the game. Nobody would be talking about how great it was, even though you could say both defenses showed up and played tremendous, but neither offense showed. Everybody would be boo. What we had yesterday in a 41-33 finale was both offenses showing up and neither defense showing up, and everybody is like, wow, that was amazing. Do you feel the same way I do, that if you don't get, you know, the best that both teams have to offer in what is then a close game, that you, I don't know, I feel almost a little bit cheated, like I watched arena football yesterday and not the Super Bowl. Am I crazy?
No, I totally understand that. I mean, you know, it's you hear contrary sometimes too. I mean, you go back in some of these games that are, you know, throughout the course of the season, where you have that close, low score, you know, people don't appreciate the defensive performance. You see, I mean, everyone, you know, what you see are the touchdowns, and what you see are the big plays, and what you see are the, you know, the 40-yard runs where the running back takes off and hits top gear and flies to the end zone. What you don't see are, you know, the really outstanding defensive plays. I mean, it's just not something that's, you know, understandable or accessible for the average fan. And I understand that. I mean, you know, offense is exciting too. And I think, you know, you look at this game, and what stood out to me wasn't so much that the defense didn't get home, but, you know, those coaches schemed for their offense really well. Both teams have really good offensive lines. Both teams are real smart about, you know, you send extra blockers, you send the running backs, you make them chip when they run their routes. It's and you saw a lot of that. I mean, Chris Long and Brandon Graham and those guys were talking about after the Super Bowl last night and just how they were having such a hard time getting home until the end of the fourth quarter, when the Patriots kind of had to open things up a little bit and start throwing the ball downfield a little more, and you didn't have a situation where the backs and the tight ends are chipping like that, and that opened things up, and they tried some, you know, instead of some power pass rushing moves, which Brandon Graham did specifically on that forced fumble, you know, they go from a bull rush to an outside move on Shaq Mason, the guard, and he gets home, sure enough. So, I mean, you know, you can kind of, you know, you pick your poison with it. I mean, more fans in the end are going to like the offense more than the defense, but, you know, I'll take the excitement overall.
I think that's fair, because I'm not going to sit here and say the game wasn't enjoyable. Certainly, you know, watching teams march up and down the field is enjoyable, but there came a point for me, outcome regardless, whether the Patriots won or the Eagles won, and I was kind of, you know, mostly pulling for the Eagles for a lot of reasons. Same reason most people around the country, not in New England or maybe in Minnesota, were rooting for the Eagles. But, you know, outcome notwithstanding, there came a point where it was like, well, there's another touchdown drive, and here comes the other guys. There's another touchdown drive, and it's like, it's almost like diminishing marginal utility. You know, you stop respecting something that comes so easily. You know, touchdowns keep their value by being relatively scarce. It's hard to do, particularly in a Super Bowl. It's kind of like a diamond. You know, what makes it valuable is that there aren't a ton of them. So when you get a good one, it's really, really valuable. And they just came so free and easy, all these scores did for both teams. I feel like it just would have been more enjoyable for somebody to get a stop, for something. You know, the tipped interception in, what was that, in the second quarter? Was that in the third? I couldn't remember now. When Alshon Jeffries had a one-handed catch and then couldn't hold it and it got picked. You know, it was like, ooh! And even that wasn't a great defensive play. It was just fortuitous that when Jeffries let go of it, it bounded right into the safety's arms. So I just was waiting for what we saw at the very end with 2 minutes and 10 seconds to go. A strip sack, you know, a big play by the defense. Somebody sniffs one out and gets a pick.
Yeah.
Massive hit force. To make the next score be more valuable, I guess, knowing that it wasn't just we're going to take turns going up and down the field.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, there was like what was one sack that there was one sack in that game. I think there was one punt in that game. You know,
right,
so it's I mean, it's really unusual for that respect alone. So I think there's a lot of people that are just happy the Patriots lost today. So
well, no doubt about
that. It seems like everyone in the stadium had a green jersey on last night. I was a little surprised.
What was the biggest key to you, you know, in that? Well, hold on. Now you got me go off on another tangent. Almost all the jerseys you thought was great. Because I was talking to a Minnesota-based reporter who actually writes for the Eagles website for on SB Nation for what is it?
Bleeding Green Nation.
Bleeding Green Nation. Thank you. I was going to do the slogan Fly Eagle Fly. They don't do that for this. But anyway, he lives in Minnesota, and he said the fans up there hate Philadelphia so much, at least Vikings fans do. So if there's any place outside of geographical New England that was going to be rooting against the Eagles and for the Patriots, it might be right up there in Minnesota. But I guess not all of those folks had tickets, since you said you saw a very pro-Eagles crowd.
Yeah, I know. It was interesting, though. You still saw a few Vikings jerseys, and we asked a couple if they had, you know, bought tickets when it looked like the Vikings had a chance to get there and just didn't want to, you know, sell them or just wanted to go the game or whatever. A couple folks that was the case, and a couple folks are just like, no, we're just Vikings fans, and we plan to go to the Super Bowl no matter who was in it this year. So
okay, well, that's good. The guy we talked to is saying that a lot of Vikings fans weren't thrilled with the way Eagles fans treated them in that game, in that NFC Championship game, and it's because of that. It's because of the fans, not because of Doug Peterson or Nick Foles or anybody with the Eagles organization, but the fans made them say, screw you, we hope New England wins. So, all right, be that as it may, let's get to the actual outcome. I have to sit here and eat a big plate of crow today. I thought that the Patriots and their experience in the Super Bowl and their tremendous advantage in coaching, Bill Belichick essentially is the greatest coach maybe to ever do this. Tom Brady's the greatest quarterback to ever play the position. I thought New England would win relatively comfortably. Obviously, that didn't happen because Bill Belichick did not outcoach Doug Peterson. Doug Peterson had an extraordinarily aggressive game plan right from the start. Was that the key to the Philadelphia victory, or as you look back on it now through four quarters, what did Philadelphia do to overcome the underdog status that they had?
Well, I just, you know, they kept their foot on the gas. I mean, you know, they were aggressive. I think going for it on fourth downs, I mean, that was something that the, you know, offensive coordinator Frank Reich talked about earlier in the week, just how that's, you know, now there's the expectation that, you know, if they're across midfield and it's, you know, somewhere underneath 5 yards to go on fourth down, they're going to go for it. I mean, that's the expectation there. So it's just that mentality that team had, and I think that's, you know, we've seen that so many times against the Patriots where some team will have them on the ropes and they get conservative or they start playing not to lose in the fourth quarter.
You mean like the Falcons last year?
Yeah, exactly. And what happens is, you know, that's where New England comes in and takes advantage. I mean, if you make one little mistake against the Patriots, they're notorious for just sort of, you know, that's enough of a crack that they can kick the door open and come back to win. And I thought that was what was going to happen last night. You know, when they get the ball back with, 2 minutes and 15 seconds left, I thought that, you know, the Eagles definitely needed that touchdown. But if anything, it might have come a little too soon for them. But, you know, that's when the defense came up big with the sack. So,
yeah, I thought the same thing as far as about that happening too soon. And that sack was simply unbelievable. The first sack of the game being at such a moment. But that's kind of what I meant about the super aggressiveness of Doug Peterson and the game plan that they had. And he addressed that a little bit at the in the post game, saying that, you know, we were going to be us. We were not going to play, for lack of a better way of saying it, in fear of the other guy. We were not going to be too conservative and worry about not making mistakes. We were going to be aggressive from the get-go. And that fourth down play and the throw to Foles, which, of course, was just so ironic that it was just a series after Brady dropped the throw back to him, was evidence of that, that we were good, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down throwing every punch we have, not dodging their punches.
Yeah, it was. And you know, I credit that the team mentality that they have, too, is one thing that's really impressive, talking to those guys and the coaches all week long and how they really rallied around each other. I mean, even with, you know, the guys, Chris Long and Malcolm Jenkins and the off-field activities that they had, you know, this season with, as far as, you know, being active in the community and stuff like that. And the team really rallied around that. And that's impressive. I mean, you just don't see that in a lot of places. And of all the teams where you didn't see that last night, I never thought it, you know, would be the New England Patriots in the Super Bowl that, you know, were making those kind of errors, you know, unforced errors throughout the game.
Yeah, I completely agree. Speaking of Malcolm, since you said Malcolm, and you were talking about Jenkins, but obviously I have to ask about Butler.
Yeah.
And you're going to just, I'm asking you to speculate here, Ryan Van Bibber of SB Nation, because Bill Belichick is no more forthcoming now than he was at halftime. And they came back and the reporter said that, you know, hey, how come Malcolm Jenkins didn't start? And he just said, we put the best players on the field to help win this game as we saw it. And then he basically repeated that in post game. So I don't have anything more than you do. A lot of former Patriots were on social media blasting the decision to sit Malcolm Butler. What do you think was going on there? Was there a disciplinarian thing going on that he doesn't want to talk about? Usually they might say violation of team rules as to why you're being benched or something, but we got nothing.
Yeah, and the Patriots are always pretty tight-lipped about that. It was a weird week for them because, like, oddly enough, with the flu season going around, we were working on a story about, you know, how players and teams work to prevent the flu. We couldn't get with a team doctor or trainer, so we didn't do it. But in talking to Butler, because, you know, he had the flu earlier in the week and had you know, made a visit to the hospital, was not actually hospitalized, but there was this real caginess about it when you talk to him, and he's like, I'm not saying nothing about it. And, you know, partly that's probably just the way the Patriots talk about injuries. I mean, they're notorious for that, but there was a tension there that was palpable, and you could see that. And I just wonder, I mean, Butler, you know, was kind of on the out. You go back to the off season before the season started, and, you know, it looked like they were going to trade Butler. It didn't look like Butler was going to be their guy. They chose not to pay him, and they went out and signed a big contract with Stephon Gilmore, you know, in March. So that was a little bit of a shock. And I think the relationship with Butler and the Patriots had soured to a certain extent back in the spring. And then obviously he plays well this season and into the playoffs, and then just sort of mysteriously benches. If I were a betting man, I'd bet that it was a disciplinary issue. Whether that was there's the rumor going around that maybe it was a curfew violation, and that's certainly a possibility. It was either a curfew violation or a run-in with the coaches of some kind, if it was anything like that. So it's a bad look for the Patriots, though. I mean, I can't believe that, you know, they didn't think to get him back in the game at some point. I mean, they stuck to their guns. He played one series the entire games. It was on special teams. And despite the fact that the Eagles were just, you know, moving the ball at will with Jeffrey and Nelson Aguilar, you know, racking up the yards, they never put Butler back out there, and that was a really curious decision to make.
Ryan Van Bibber joining us from SBNation.com, NFL writer. It was curious, although, the fact that this is the Patriots makes me just kind of, I don't know, almost think they know what the heck they're doing. It's part of that the Patriot way thing. In other words, for Bill Belichick, it's not just about this game. Even though, of course, we want to win this game. It's our next and would be most recent Super Bowl. That's the whole thing they go for. But in the bigger picture for Bill Belichick, it's if it is indeed a curfew violation or something of that nature, like you just pointed out, Ryan, it's so much bigger than that. If you don't follow our rules to the letter, you don't play. And then we will cut your A and you can go someplace else. That's how they are the most disciplined team in football. A lot of people say, well, the reason they have fewer penalties than others is because the referees favor them. And I think we found out last night in two very close controversial catch calls that's not necessarily the case. But it's because we expect perfection when it comes to discipline, rule following, et cetera. And you don't enforce that just when it's convenient. You have to enforce that even on the brightest stage like this one. And I just wonder if that message wasn't as much to Malcolm Butler as it is to everybody else who plays for the Patriots or whoever hopes to play for the Patriots.
Yeah, and that's a good point because you saw some of this, and I'm not I don't put too much stock into the tea leaves you read on social media, but it was real interesting because you had Brandon Browner, who former Patriot, made some comments about that whole situation on his Instagram page, and you had a few players on the Patriots defense, you know, like that post, and you get the sense that I wonder if this was, you know, being the last game of the season, if maybe there wasn't a way they got him in there, unless it was just sort of like, you know, they were stemming off a larger issue within the locker room, which could very well be the case too.
Yeah, it very well could be, and I don't know what to make of it, but I hope somehow, some way, and it might not be until somebody writes a tell-all book after Bill Belichick retires, because nobody's going to do it while he's around anyway. But you know, hopefully we'll find that out. Let's talk about Gronk. He was very quiet in the first half. He exploded in the second half. Tom Brady kind of realized, and Danny Amendola, after being the main, you know, go-to guy for Brady in the comeback against Jacksonville, he was also very quiet in this game. But Brady kind of realized, I need to involve my best playmaking receiver, who happens to be my tight end, and there was a stretch of the game where Gronk and Brady took it over. And now, despite that positive, even though the game was a loss, the positive, you know, what do you want to come back from his injury, concussion protocol and whatnot, and having really a great game for himself personally. After the game, Gronk said, I'm very seriously going to consider my future here. He is not committing to coming back. Do you think he retires, and does that surprise you if he does?
It was really surprising to hear that, first of all. I mean, you know, he's not even 30 years old yet. So, I mean, it's not like he's, even by NFL player standards, is old. And I know he's had a lot of injuries throughout his career and this year too, and you know, that's not fun for a player to have to go through. But, you know, I would be willing to say that, you know, he will probably be back next season. I don't see him retiring this soon. I think it's maybe just, you know, you get caught up in the disappointment of losing the Super Bowl, and you know, it's not something the Patriots have had to deal with a lot. I mean, it's just not, it's not a common feeling for them, and so to have to go through that beat up, and you know, maybe he had a concussion, so maybe he wasn't feeling all that great this week anyway, and then you go out and you play a good game and you lose it despite, you know, a pretty incredible offensive effort with him and Brady. So, you know, we saw this a little bit with Roethlisberger. You saw it, you know, earlier this year with Earl Thomas in Seattle, the safety there, who, you know, talked about retirement and then walked it back to just, you know, out of off-the-cuff remarks about being disappointed with, you know, his injury status and the progress that they made that season. So I think for now, you probably, like, I wouldn't worry too much if you own a Gronkowski jersey, or if, you know, you're thinking about keeping him in your fantasy league that goes from year to year over roster. I think you're probably safe.
All right, and Tom Brady, of course, has to answer that question all the time, even though he had just the night before been crowned NFL MVP for the third time, joining three other Hall of Fame greats as the only three-time winners. And then he throws for 505 yards at age 40 in the Super Bowl without his best deep threat, who got knocked out very early in the game, Brandon Cooks. It's amazing to me, and I just cannot say enough about Tom Brady. And I was never a huge Brady fan, but, I mean, my God, last year in the Super Bowl, he comes back down 28-3 without Rob Gronkowski. Yesterday, he comes back and takes the lead 33-32 without Brandon Cooks, with Chris Hogan, with somebody named Burkhead, with a little bit of Danny Amendola. I mean, it doesn't matter what no-name, blue-collar, lunch-pail guys he has on his side of the ball. Every single year, he turns crappy players into good ones, good ones into average players into good ones, and then I shouldn't have said crappy, and then good ones into great ones, just by the offensive design that they use, and then his ability to read defenses and make plays. So, what is Brady's future here? He said after the game, "Look, the game ended 15 minutes ago. Give me some time, but no, I can see no reason whatsoever why I would not be back next year." How much longer
goes? We'll see how long the difference between how long he wants to go and how long his body actually lets him go. You know, he's been fortunate that he hasn't, this year or the last year, hasn't really had to deal with a significant injury. And I think that's one thing that, you know, with a player at that age and that stage of their career, that's the problem where you start to see, if they can stay healthy, they can be okay. But as soon as they start to have, you know, a knee injury, or, you know, the most recent obvious example that really comes to mind is Peyton Manning. You know, he goes out to Denver and he has two great seasons in Denver and then he just kind of falls off the cliff. Well, what happens is he gets hurt at the end of the season before that and has to spend the off season rehabbing. And when you're, you know, a 40-year-old body is a lot harder to rehab and you don't get to prepare for the season at 100% because you're rehabbing an injury. Now Brady's not in that situation.
Exactly.
So
that's
a good sign.
Yeah, the big difference there is, of course, we found out toward the end of Peyton Manning's last season, he couldn't even feel the football. He had no feeling in the nerve endings in his fingertips on his passing hand, all related to his four neck surgeries. So, you know, that's a really difficult thing to do. I'm going to try to throw the ball and put something on it. I can't even feel the thing. Brady, while you're right, certainly about your 40-year-old body, he doesn't have anything like that he has had to deal with.
No, but, you know, that could happen in week one. That could happen in OTAs. That could happen in training camp. It could happen in week 10. I mean, it's just, you know, a player that age, it's just, you know, an injury like that is much more of a career threatener than it is for a guy in his third, fourth, or fifth season. So I think that's kind of one thing to keep an eye on for Brady in the future. And I also think, too, it's like there's no way that they would have, you know, would have traded Jimmy Garoppolo if they had anything but some sort of indication from Brady that he planned to play for a few more years. And you saw that in that ESPN article that came out in, what, early December, mid-December from Seth Wickersham about the feud in the organization, not feud, but, you know, the tension in the organization between Brady and Belichick and Kraft. But, you know, that was sort of an underpinning of it, was that Brady wanted to keep on playing and they wanted to hang on to Garoppolo, but they couldn't really afford to do that because they thought that, you know, he would be the guy that would take over for Brady. And now they don't have a backup plan, so it's Brady or bust.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right about that. And just briefly before you go, and Ryan, thanks again for your time. Let's go back to the winner's side again, and let's talk about Nick Foles. Carson Wentz is obviously still the man. He's not going to lose his job. Nick Foles, however, really has to have won a job someplace with his performance, not only yesterday, but going to the NFC Championship game and two elimination games, the biggest games of his life. He lit up the best defense in the league against Minnesota. And then even though it's not the best defense in the league anymore, it's the Patriots defense in the Super Bowl. And he lit that one up too. Where's Nick Foles next year?
Well, I mean, I think for start, my money for now is probably that he stays in Philly in 2018, just because he's under contract, and so it's a reasonable contract. It's not an onerous cap hit for Philly, and Carson Wentz is still on his rookie deal, so that's not a big cap hit for Philly. So they don't have a lot of money tied up at quarterback. So I think they're probably smart just to hang on to Foles. I mean, I expect Wentz to be fine for the start of the season, but if his rehab takes a little longer or if they want to, you know, give him a little extra time to get ready, then they've got, you know, a good, capable backup that they're comfortable with to start the season. So, or if, you know, if Wentz does start the season, he gets injured again, their Super Bowl hopes, as we saw this year, their Super Bowl hopes in 2018 aren't dead because Wentz is out for any stretch of time. So that's, you know, I think the safest bet for the Eagles is just to hang on to him right now. Now,
what if somebody throws a trade offer at them?
Exactly.
For example, a team that we cover out here, the Clowns, they have, what, 14 picks again or something stupid, including 1 and 4 and a bunch of 2s, and I don't even keep track of them anymore. And ironically, and many of those assets came in the deal that they made when they passed up on Carson Wentz and let Philadelphia take them. And now they might have to give some of those assets back for Carson Wentz's backup to make him their guy. Any chance of that?
It's certainly a chance of that. It'll be interesting to see what other teams might be in the mix for Nick Foles, or because you've got a pretty interesting quarterback market this year. You know, there's not only a Foles might be dangled out there. There's, you know, the situation in Minnesota. What's going to happen to Case Keenum, Sam Bradford, and Teddy Bridgewater? None of them are under contract this year. There's the Kirk Cousins situation, which will kind of set the market for quarterbacks, depending on, you know, whether or not Washington screws that up with this franchise tag thing they were talking about yesterday. So, but I think the market kind of sets itself from there. And if somebody feels like Nick Foles is their guy, my only word of warning to that is Nick Foles is not a bad quarterback, but he's probably not a franchise player in the sense that this is a guy you want to spend $22 million a year on. And you've got to be pretty comfortable and pretty confident with the system you're bringing him into, because he had everything a quarterback could want in Philadelphia. He had an outstanding offensive line. He's got outstanding playmakers around him. He's got an outstanding ground game to build that play action game around. And it's just, you know, that's a coach that knows how to use him, a coach that knows his strengths and tailors the offense to his strengths. I mean, just look at the difference in that offense with Wentz and Foles, and then the different parts of the playbook they use with those two guys. And that's smart coaching, and there's not a lot of smart coaching in the NFL right now.
I think that's very well said. There really isn't. Ryan Van Bibber, read him and follow him at SBNation.com NFL page. Really good stuff, Ryan. Thanks so much for analyzing the Super Bowl with us. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll catch up with you again as we get closer to the draft to figure out what in the hell these teams, especially teams like the Browns, are going to do. All right?
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks, Ryan. Great stuff. All right, 3:37. We're a little bit behind our clock here, and that's okay. It's the Super Bowl discussion, our Super Bowl reaction show. And, you know, Ryan reacted. I've reacted. Christian hasn't reacted much yet. He will. And I want you to react to some of those questions. If you're a Browns fan, do you go after Nick Foles as your bridge guy for 2 or 3 years to either, you know, to Deshaun Kizer, if he's your guy of the future, or to maybe the guy you take number one overall? Do you want Nick Foles? Do you want to invest that kind of money in that veteran to be your guy? So we'll talk about that. And then also I want to talk about the Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski question. And let me just say this, by the way. This is more opining, but that's what I do. I don't care that he lost and he's now 5-3 in Super Bowls. 5-3 in Super Bowls. Tom Brady is still the greatest quarterback who ever lived. He would have been that in victory. He is that in defeat. He did not lose the game, quite frankly. And Lions fans aren't going to want to hear this. Matt Patricia's defense lost the Patriots the game. How concerned are you about that if you're a Lions fan? And, Jim, I think you'll remember I asked this very question on Friday's program, that if the Philadelphia Eagles, behind a backup quarterback named Nick Foles, light up the New England Patriots defense coached by Matt Patricia, will it be a sign of concern for Lions fans? Considering that Patricia will be taking that job and making it official probably tomorrow as the head coach of the Lions. And lo and behold, that's the question we have before us. So we're going to talk about that too. 866-240-1065 is the number to join us. We'll get you a bottom of the hour sports center right after we get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports.
And as you can imagine, we got a ton of wild stats from the Super Bowl yesterday. Let's just list a few of them for you here. The 74 combined points in the game, now the second most all-time in a single Super Bowl, one shy of the record set by the Niners and Chargers back in Super Bowl 29. The 1,151 combined total yards, the most ever in any NFL game. Ever in history, regular season or playoffs, let alone Super Bowls. Tom Brady, Rob Gronkowski now have hooked up for 12 playoff touchdowns in their careers, tied for the most in NFL history with, you guessed it, Joe Montana, Jerry Rice. New England's 613 total yards yesterday, the most in any loss in NFL history, regular season or playoffs. Forget about Super Bowl. And in total, 17 other various Super Bowl records, be single game or career, were broken in this one. Also, NFL MVPs now 1-9. In Super Bowls in their MVP years. There you have it, your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stats, plural, of the day. Bottom of the hour Sports Center coming up. Then let's get you on the radio reacting to Super Bowl 52 right here on ESPN 106.5.
It's taken care of because I handled it yesterday hat. My favorite hat? My I received an order from Granger hat. I look my best in that one. Granger's got the products I need and gets me them when I need them, no matter what hat I'm wearing that day. You know what? I love Granger. You know why? Because Granger's got my back. Call clickgranger.com or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Right back indeed. We roll onward at 3:46. Thanks for joining us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Coming up in about an hour, we're going to talk to Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. Get away from the Super Bowl for just a little bit. Talk about Buckeye Hoops, Kata Bates-Diop had a monster game over the weekend. We'll talk a little bit about that. But the biggest game, of course, the monster game, was the one held last night, and the Philadelphia Eagles. Kush, I want to ask everybody the same question I asked Ryan Van Bibber at the top of the show, or top of the interview. 866-240-1065 if you choose to answer. Jim, did you feel any disappointment in the way the game was played, in the product that was presented to us by the fact that it was all offense and no defense, the fact that there was like one punt, the fact that there was one sack, the fact that there was no drama. There wasn't like an, oh my God, an interception deep in Patriots territory. Can the Eagles take advantage? That there wasn't any, oh, a huge fourth down stop. There was no defensive drama. No, I just feel like I watched half a game. I feel like, you know what's really goofy? It's going to sound goofy. I feel like I watched an entire Super Bowl of college overtime where each team got the ball at the 25 going in, and they just traded scores until somebody screwed up something. Because that's how it was, even though they had to go 75, 80 yards most of the time. Both teams just zipped down the field one after the other, just racking up the points, the record for any NFL game in history, 1,100-plus yards that we just talked about. And while points are exciting, there comes a point where home runs are boring. If the game is 16-14 in the 13th inning because no pitcher can get any batters out, and it's just, you know, the guy, you know, guys taking turns teeing off, you know, it's like, oh, they put up a four spot in the bottom or in the top of the 11th. That'll do it until the bottom of the 11th. Oh, and they come right back with four solo shots on their own. It's like, really? Here's another one. It's yawning. It's beer league softball. And that's how it felt yesterday for me for a large part of that game, where it's like there isn't a question of getting a stop. It's who's just going to make the biggest mistake first, because neither team can stop the other. And I don't necessarily find that any more thrilling than I would a field goal festival of 9-6, because the defenses couldn't be penetrated.
You know, and that's an interesting take on it. I mean, you know, for me, the fact that there was no defense on either side of this one is something that should be noted. It's one of the reasons that from some, you know, I'm sure you've heard the same kind of comments since last night from a few people that, oh, this may be one of the best Super Bowls ever. No, I'm not willing to put it on that list because you only saw half of football, as you're describing, all offense on both sides and no defense whatsoever. Except, of course, the one time the defense does rear its ugly head was at the very end of it, where you force the fumble, which is about the only way to stop the Patriots at that point, because the Eagles defense wasn't stopping anybody, you know, either. The only drama aspect, Bob, that I took from this game, it was two separate times, if you recall. One of them halfway through the third quarter, and the Eagles are up 10, and all I kept thinking at that moment is, now how are they going to blow this one? How are Brady and them going to come back from this one?
That's better.
And they did. They were leading for a moment.
Yeah, no, because there was never a question about that. There was never a question that Brady was going to bring them back. But I didn't necessarily think it was going to be that Philadelphia would blow it. It would just be recognition of greatness for the sake of greatness. Tom Brady isn't going to be down 10 in the third quarter and allow that to stand. You think that guy's not going to come back with 10 points at some point, or come back with 20 points if his team gives up 30, if his team gives up 10 in some way to even or take the lead in that game. So there was no question about it, but I never thought of it about from the standpoint of Philadelphia blowing it. Because of what we saw last year in the way that the Falcons blew it.
Yes.
They had a 28-3 lead and just got so conservative and said, we're going to sit on this and work the clock and blah, 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 instead of being aggressive. But you saw the one thing in this game that was not going to be similar, and we saw it from very early on, particularly with that fourth down play and the touchdown pass to Nick Foles, and some of the greatest chicanery I think you're going to see in a Super Bowl game. Maybe one of the ballsiest, most fun play calls, even though it very nearly mirrored the play that the Patriots had just run. This one was different because A, it worked and the pass was caught, and B, because it was a goal line play, a touchdown play, as opposed to the one that they threw to Brady. It was just a little bit out over his head and, you know, a little bit off his fingertips, which would have been for a first down, not for a touchdown. But that was an example on fourth down of going for it and not kicking a field goal and being conservative that let me know they're not here just to hang tough. They're here to take it to Bill Belichick, to give him a taste of his own medicine. We are coming after you, and we're not just going to try to hang with you and then hope that we make a play at the end. Mm-hmm. Doug Peterson made it very clear that he was not going to, quote-unquote, fold or let his team just collapse. If New England wanted to win it, they were going to have to take it from him.
And you heard in our montage here at the top of the show, both Doug Peterson and Nick Foles alluding to the fact that, you know, our plan was, you know, that we were going to go out there and we were going to be aggressive about this. And that's the right way to handle it. That absolutely is. And as you're pointing out, correctly so, last year's game, Patriots-Falcons, is exactly why you do that, because as long as Brady and Belichick are there, even 28-3 isn't safe. So you have to keep doing those things and staying aggressive. And, you know, to their credit, they were able to pull it off.
Yeah, no question about it. It was, and that was a remarkable thing. So I want to ask Browns fans a little bit of a question here. In addition to the, what's that?
I know where you're going with this. I tweeted this very thing last night.
Which was?
About, just continue. I have a feeling I know what this is about.
All right. Well, it's not a mystery because I teased it right before the Sports Center. I just want to talk about Nick Foles. My question is did you see, because, you know, look, they tried to make an offer for Alex Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Smith never won a Super Bowl. Nick Foles has now won a Super Bowl. And he didn't just game manage a Super Bowl the way Brad
right.
Johnson did with the Buccaneers and their great defense in 2003. He didn't game manage a Super Bowl the way Trent Dilfer did 2 years before that. The guy won the Super Bowl. The guy was the MVP of the Super Bowl. The guy
threw three
touchdown passes and caught a touchdown pass in the Super Bowl. And he did this on a team that, quite frankly, had no business doing this to the New England Patriots in the Super Bowl or the Minnesota Vikings. Remember, the Minnesota Vikings had the best defense in the National Football League. He personally shredded it. The Patriots didn't have the best defense, but they had the Patriots defense and Bill Belichick's defense and Matt Patricia's defense in the Super Bowl, and he shredded it. So my question is, do you believe, Browns fans, that this might be the answer? You made a good, I think it was a second-round draft pick offer to the Chiefs for Alex Smith. Andy Reid and the Chiefs basically said, we don't want to do that to Alex. We like the guy. So we're not going to trade him to you. We'll take less from the Washington Redskins and trade him there. So they are clearly willing to trade for the right veteran backup quarter or the right veteran quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Alex Smith has largely been a starter in his career. Nick Foles has largely been a backup. But based on performance, based on achievement, based on championships, Nick Foles can now say, look what I have. Yeah, Carson quarterbacked the first 12, but I quarterbacked the last four and the playoff, divisional round, championship round, and Super Bowl, and here are my numbers. If you ask me, if you're willing to make a pitch for an Alex Smith, if you're Cleveland, you make yourself a pitch for Nick Foles. What do you think?
I'm not 100% sure if the Browns will do this or even if they should, but I will say that one side has to be calling the other at this point. Well, what I thought of late last night, you know, after this game goes final is, you know, if I'm the Eagles, I'm calling the Browns and seeing if I could draft a movie style swindle them, because they should be the most desperate guy, you know. And there is a quirk, which is why you're going to start hearing this more and more as the next days and weeks and such go by. Nick Foles has a funky contract. Here's what I mean by that. The contract gets voided basically 1 year from today if he is still a Philadelphia Eagle. Technically, the contract runs through 2021, but again, if he's still a Philadelphia Eagle at basically this date in 2019, so after next season, then the contract gets voided. And it's a reasonable contract. He's only going to make $4 million base salary, $600,000 signing bonus for next year. And even at the end of the deal in 2021, it's $5.5 million and $600,000 for those same two numbers. So it's not ridiculous for a Browns or, quite frankly, anybody who might want to try to get in on this. We certainly know the Browns have the type of assets to make a kind of, or at least make an offer. Now, what the Eagles do with it is still part of a different story, because if you're the Eagles, by the same token, okay, we lose him if he's still on our team, which gives us the impetus to trade him. But for 2018, at minimum, if he's still in Philadelphia, well, we know we are absolutely set at quarterback. And as Ryan Van Bibber pointed out in the last segment with us, since you have that one I just laid out for Foles, plus Carson Wentz still on his rookie contract, contract-wise, they're probably one of the best set-up teams now in the entire NFL at quarterback. So as I've had 12 to 14, 16 hours or so to think about this, I'm not 100% sure if the Eagles would want to move him just because, hey, we want to keep this safe. I don't think they would want to move him.
But if you are blown away with picks, you might have no choice
right.
but to move him. Remember, you are now going to be drafting last.
Yep.
You are now a team, and as good as they are, they're not a flawless team. This is not a perfect team. They have needs, and they have holes. And, yeah, we can try to fill them with the picks that we get at the very end of each of the seven rounds. Or, you know what, we've got a luxury here in a guy that a lot of people want. And if the price is driven up perhaps by some other clubs who are quarterback desperate and quarterback hungry, and the Browns end up giving them, you know, something that is too hard to, you know, to say no to, in the same way that they gave the Browns a bevy of picks that were too hard to say no to in exchange for the right to draft Carson Wentz in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You could pry him away is kind of the point there. Let me get a quick call in here, Jim, before the top of the hour.
We just lost him.
Oh, we did. Okay, yeah. My apologies. I was gonna do that. But if you want to get in, we'll get in after the top of the hour then, because we're short on time anyway, at 866-240-1065. But would you, if you're a Browns fan, want to bring Nick Foles here, or has this already been tried and done? We knew that Nick Foles was a good backup quarterback who came in and played well, but does that mean he's a starter? He's been given a chance to do that. It didn't work out well. That's why he's back again to where he is.
And he had a couple halfway decent weapons plus yep. a great offensive line. One would just sit and wonder, yeah, well, how's that all going to look with the orange helmets in front of him? I bet it's not the same.
I completely agree. That is a very, very different story altogether. In the same way that a guy like DeShone Kizer might have done a lot better in his rookie year in a place that didn't have the weak receivers, bad offensive line, and the orange helmet. So we'll get into that. I want to get your thoughts at 866-240-1065. Keep that number in mind, by the way, because here's what I'm going to do on the way in. I'm going to give you an opportunity to score a pair of tickets to the Toledo Golf Show, which is coming up at Tam O'Shanter February 16th through the 18th. So if you would like to hit this par five. How about you birdie this par five, all right? Caller five at 866-240-1065. Caller number five right now. We'll give you a pair of tickets to the Toledo Golf Show. Dial now, and good luck to you. We're coming back with hour number two, Paul Keels at 440. Your phone call's coming up next right here on the ticket.
Off play action. Going for it all into the end zone, and it is caught. Alshon Jeffrey for the touchdown.
And Nick Foles told us, he said, early in this game, I want to be able to take my shot.
Blunt is in the backfield. LeGarrette Blunt swings to the outside, inside the 10. Blunt to the end zone, behind a Celek block. His 11th career postseason TD. Big hole left side, James White. Inside the 10, takes it to the end zone. Touchdown, Patriots. And they're going to snap it. And it's Trey Burton who throws caught. Foles, touchdown.
Here we go. They've got all these signals. Shotgun, he would not have been eligible but for the fact he was in the shotgun, not under center. And there's the old basketball player.
Four-man rush, and then it's caught. Gronkowski for the touchdown. The pass into the end zone, and it is Corey Clement. Yes, touchdown.
How many times, Al, do we come into the Super Bowl and we say, who is it? Who's the unknown?
Play fake on first down. To the end zone, caught. Touchdown, Hogan. And Brady lost one for Gronkowski, reaching for it. Touchdown. They look unstoppable right now. From the 12.
Zach Ertz out wide, one-on-one.
Clement flares out to the right, caught over the middle, and into the end zone. Zach Ertz for the touchdown. And again, all you can think back to now is the Jesse James play with Pittsburgh. Does he complete the process?
The receiver possesses the football, becomes a runner, breaks the plane of the goal line. The ruling is confirmed. It is a touchdown.
Uh-oh. Brady gets hit. The ball is out. And Philadelphia has it. Derek Barnett comes away with it.
Pays huge dividends with the first sack fumble of the game.
Brady under pressure. Escapes the sack. Launching one for the end zone. It's a jump ball and it's incomplete. And Gronk was there. And time runs out. And for the Philadelphia Eagles, the long drought is over.
I felt good. I mean, you never really know what it's going to be like when you're going to a Super Bowl. I've never been here before, so There are normal nerves. You got butterflies. I mean, it's a big game. I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than this. So, but I felt good. I felt calm. I think the big thing that helped me was knowing that I didn't have to be Superman. I have amazing teammates, amazing coaches around me. And all I had to do was just go play as hard as I could and play for one another, play for those guys. You know, not look at the scoreboard, not look at the time. Just go out there and play. Don't worry about it. That was something we've been working on, and Doug and I were talking. I was like, let's just run it. It was a good time. The end was a little wider than I thought, so I was like, I really need to sell like I'm not doing anything. It worked. Trey made an amazing throw right on the money. I just looked it in. We've repped it for a while, so I was excited to get it run and in the Super Bowl.
You know, I trust my instincts. I trust everything that I'm doing, and I want to maintain that aggressiveness with the guys. In games like this against a great opponent, you got to make those tough decisions that way and keep yourself aggressive. Yeah, I'm so happy for Nick. A lot like this football team, a lot of people counted him out and didn't think he could get it done, and I believed in him. The staff believed in him. The players believed in him. You know, this whole postseason, Nick has shown exactly who he is and what he can do and what he's capable of doing. He's well-deserved of the honor.
It wasn't quite enough. Obviously, didn't do a good enough job coaching. Missed a lot of opportunities offensively in the first half. Didn't play good enough defense. Just wasn't quite enough against a good team like Philadelphia. Just couldn't quite make enough plays to come out on top tonight. It's disappointing.
I'd obviously love to not have it stripped from me. I was just holding the ball, trying to get it downfield, and those guys had a good rush and got in there and made a good play. It's tough to lose these games. I mean, but again, you can't win the game if you're not in the game, and you play to win, and sometimes you lose. I'm disappointed. Wish we could have done a better job. I expect to be back, so we'll see. I mean, it's 15 minutes after the game ended. I'd like to process this a little bit, and I wouldn't see why I wouldn't be back.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed hour number two rolling along here at 14 minutes after 4 o'clock. Congratulations, Dan Tomaszewski of Bowling Green. He won the golf show tickets, and we'll have more of those to give away throughout the rest of this week in advance of the golf show. So we are Super Bowl heavy today. However, it will not be Super Bowl exclusive. Number one, we're going to be talking with Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, coming up at about 4:40, 4:45, about the Buckeyes who continue to roll on in a spectacular debut season for their new head coach. Coach Haldeman is doing some great things with that group. We'll talk to Paul about that. But number two, we're also going to talk about the NBA because, Kush, I'm sure you observed the Cavaliers' latest embarrassing, shocking, horrific, terrible,
ugh,
putrid.
I wish
pathetic,
I hadn't observed it.
Shameful.
Let's put it that way.
Give me a thesaurus here so I can find out things that say suck.
You got most of them.
Against the Rockets. Embarrassing. Lost by, what did they end up losing by? 35? I know they were down 35 at one point. Maybe it was 30 or 25 at the end of the whole thing. But it was, it is just an absolutely embarrassing thing that is going on over there in Cleveland. So we have that part of the story to talk about as well. LeBron James, how much of this does he own versus how much of it will he take? How much will he accept? Because a lot of this goes on him and a lot of this goes on Ty Lue, the head coach, who was personally handpicked, I believe, by LeBron James when he forced the firing of David Blatt. This team is a wreck. They cannot defend, and I promise you, Cushlin, I promise you, if David Blatt was still their head coach, they would not be as putrid of a defensive team as they are.
Yeah.
It is one thing that he absolutely made his mark on. Hold your thought on that.
Okay.
Because I want to lay out the other non-Super Bowl thing.
Yes.
Number two, Matt Patricia has been officially announced as the new head coach, obviously, of the Detroit Lions. They will have an introductory press conference at right about the time we start our show, I believe. I think it's set for 3 o'clock on Wednesday. Is it?
Yes, as of right now, it is tentatively for a Wednesday afternoon. I'm working on somebody for a Thursday to give us all the lowdown on that.
And I'm very much looking forward to hearing what he has to say. They literally just kind of made this announcement in the last hour or so that it is official. It's been the worst-kept secret in town, but it's official. He's now the 27th head coach in franchise history, less than a day after coaching maybe his worst game as a defensive coordinator.
Oof.
I have to ask, if you're a Lions fan, does it worry you at all that a man who hangs his hat on the defensive side of the ball just gave up, or let me rephrase, was party to the worst defensive performance in the history of the Super Bowl? They gave up. The Eagles and the Patriots combined to give up over 1,150 yards of total offense. He gave up 41 points to Nick Foles, not to Carson Wentz, a good could be, would be, might have been, should have been MVP, but to his backup, Nick Foles. Does this concern you at all? Matt Patricia has spent his entire NFL coaching career in New England. Started out, as you may or may not realize, as an offensive assistant. Then moved all the way up to defensive coordinator in 2012. He's been there with Bill Belichick since that time in that position. He has made three Super Bowls running the Patriots defense, winning a pair of them. So you say to yourself, okay, well, big picture is obviously that's a great resume. And it is. But little picture, and this might just be prisoner of the moment, Matt Patricia is coming off of a horrific performance by his defense against an offense that was not a juggernaut this season, either under, well, it was a juggernaut for a period of time, I take that back, under Carson Wentz, but which should not have been a juggernaut under Nick Foles, at least in my opinion. And he just shredded that Patriots defense. So I'm sure there will be some questions there about that. But, yeah, they, I mean, during various points of the season, that was a juggernaut Philadelphia Eagles offense. We should be clear about that. They put up 51 on the Broncos. They put up 37 on the Cowboys, 43 on the Rams, 34 on the Giants, 34 on the Redskins, 33 on the 49ers. I mean, yeah, this was a very capable offense to put up big numbers, and 38 on the number one defense in the league last or 2 weeks ago, the Minnesota Vikings. So they're certainly capable of doing this sort of thing. It's just not something you would expect the Patriots to give up in the Super Bowl. So Matt Patricia is the head coach, and I want to know how you feel about that. And then the third non-Super Bowl thing, although that was related to the Super Bowl, we're talking about the Lions now. But the third thing is, of course, what we found out on Saturday, the day before the Super Bowl, the latest induction class to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio, was announced. And it is a star-studded one. Make no mistake about that. The general manager of the Washington Redskins in the 1990s, as well as the, 1980s, and then the Chargers in the 1990s, Bobby Bethard. Robert Brazil, linebacker from the Houston Oilers, played in the 70s and early 80s. These are names you're not going to be as familiar with. Jerry Kramer, who was a stalwart offensive guard for the Super Bowl-winning Green Bay Packers in their championship years in the late 50s and in the early 60s. Jerry Kramer finally gets it. He was the only guard selected for the NFL's all 50th anniversary team and was the lead blocker for one of the best running back tandems in league history, and he had to wait until 2018 to get his name called. Congrats to Jerry Kramer. But the big names that you are much more familiar with, Brian Dawkins, hard-hitting, rock-solid free safety for the Philadelphia Eagles for most of his career, for the Denver Broncos for the last 2 years of his career. He was a heart-and-soul type guy for the Philadelphia team that advanced to the NFC Championship game 4 straight years. And, yes, that includes in Super Bowl 39, in which they lost, but he was a monster. He was selected to 9 Pro Bowls and is one of a very short list of players who had at least 35 interceptions and 20 sacks in his career. That is a tremendous defensive player. Brian Dawkins is joined on the defensive side of the ball by, of course, Ray Lewis. I'll talk about him in a minute. Ray Lewis, 13-time Pro Bowler, 2-time NFL Defensive Player of the Year, 2-time Super Bowl champion. Hard to deny his on-field credentials. But then there is the question of Ray Lewis making this list in his first year of eligibility, given his off-the-field situations. Let's put it that way. Brian Urlacher, who was a contemporary of Ray Lewis's. Ray Lewis played from 1996 to 2012. Brian Urlacher came in 2000 and played until 2012. So obviously didn't play quite as long, but was a monster in the middle, obviously, of those Bears defenses, including a Super Bowl team. First year of eligibility for Urlacher as well. Finished his career, 8-time Pro Bowl selection. One of the most athletic players in the league, defensive player of the year once in 05, and a member of the NFL 2000s all-decade team. So Brian Urlacher making it in the same position in the same year of eligibility as first with Ray Lewis might be surprising to some. And that brings us to the two wide receivers. Randy Moss, another first year of eligibility. It's really impossible, again, to deny his on-field credentials. Randy Moss going in as the second all-time touchdown receiver in NFL history. He caught 156 touchdown passes in his career. He finished his eight years of at least 1,200 yards receiving and 7 years of at least 70 catches. He was a six-time Pro Bowl selection, averaged at least 15 yards per catch in eight of his 16 seasons. Without question, the most talented wide receiver in the history of the National Football League. Notice what I said there. Most talented. Not best, because that still belongs to Jerry Rice, but most talented with speed you can't fathom, height and leaping ability that just shouldn't be fair. And most of the time it wasn't, which is why he caught 156 touchdown passes. But his off-the-field stuff and some of his on-the-field stuff not related to production, well, there's a conversation to be had there as well. He played not for one, not for two, not for three, not even for four, but for five teams in his NFL career. Normally, Hall of Fame talents don't bounce around that much. If they do bounce around that much, there's a reason for it. And the reason for it is because they don't necessarily bring enough good things to a team's locker room, sideline, and field to complement his tremendous talent. For example, Ray Lewis played his entire career, 1996 to 2012, that's 15 years, I believe, if you're scoring at home, all with the Baltimore Ravens. That's the way it's usually supposed to be. Urlacher, all with the Chicago Bears. Not five teams. And that takes us to T.O. Terrell Owens had just one of the greatest careers in the history of the National Football League. On the field, a force that was really hard to defend. His size was really unparalleled, not in terms of height, like Moss was taller, but he was a physical freak when it comes to his strength and his physique. He could muscle past and through guys catching the ball in traffic, as well as run right by them because of that elite speed. Terrell Owens, unquestionably, one of the greatest receivers in history. Five 1,200-yard receiving seasons, second all-time in receiving touchdowns, or excuse me, in receiving yards, 15,934 of them, if you're wondering. Third in touchdown catches, behind only Moss and Jerry Rice. He had 153 touchdown catches. No question about his talent on the field. Slight question when it comes to drops, because for all of the great receivers, probably had the drops he's more than the likes of Rice, Moss, Carter, Largent, Swan, Warfield, and on down the line of some of the great wide receivers, and I'm not going to list them all, obviously. But probably had the drops more, but still, just the production, the numbers that I just read to you, you cannot deny, you cannot argue with. I can't argue with his selection to the Hall of Fame on his third ballot, his third year of eligibility. Like Randy Moss, Terrell Owens played for not one, not two, not three, not four, but also five different football teams. He played for the Niners, the Eagles, the Cowboys, the Bills, and then ultimately the Bengals. How can an all-time Hall of Fame talent bounce around from team to team? How is he not kept locked in the city in which he started if he's that great? And the answer is he didn't bring enough positive things to the locker room, to the sideline, and to the field for the teams that he played for. He wore himself out. He essentially brought more discord and more drama to the teams than his production, as prodigious as it was worth, in a lot of the same ways Moss did. With the probable exception being Moss's problems were kind of more behavioral without seeking the spotlight compared to Owens, who was a behavior problem, who wanted everybody to know how he felt, who wanted everybody to see his behavioral issues. And in the process, Terrell Owens ruined many quarterbacks' seasons. Whether it be ruining the career of Jeff Garcia in San Francisco by hinting and intimating that he might be gay. And again, I'm not making a commentary on that, but this is the way that it goes in the National Football League. by doing those kinds of things, throwing him under the bus publicly for performance and then for personal reasons such as that, to then undermining Donovan McNabb in a Super Bowl season, for crying out loud. In Super Bowl 39, he was a tremendous performer and a huge, huge part of what they did. Talking about Terrell Owens, but he spent his time undermining Donovan McNabb. He just was a quarterback killer in so many different places, making you wonder, is there a way, if you're a Hall of Fame voter, to reconcile statistics which are measurable with impact on teams which is not measurable from a chart or on the back of a football card or on footballreference.com? There's no way to measure those two things together. But I'll just say this. Ray Lewis, unquestionable, despite his off-the-field stuff, because not only was he a great player individually statistically, he won two Super Bowls. That matters. Brian Urlacher, statistically phenomenal, also made a Super Bowl. Terrell Owens, Randy Moss, despite all of their personal statistics and accomplishments, neither one of them is going to be wearing a championship ring into their retirement. Neither one of them is going to say, what I did contributed to my team's greatness that won a championship. In fact, you might argue that what I did contributed to some of my team's coming up short. Let's put it that way. Particularly talking more about Terrell Owens than I am Randy Moss here, because Terrell Owens just cost his team, I think, in many, many ways, the chemistry, the positive vibe, the contributions to team unity, et cetera, et cetera, that really are necessary for teams to win championships. I can't let all of this commentary go by without finishing up on Ray Lewis, despite all the positive things that I just said. Is there room in the Hall of Fame for a guy? Christian, did they ever remove? I don't think they did. Did they? They never removed the bust of O.J. Simpson from the Hall, did they?
I don't believe so.
There was talk about whether they would or they should. Had he been convicted, he surely would have, I think, had that removed. But he was acquitted in the criminal trial, even though he was convicted in the civil trial, and then went to prison for, he was originally sentenced for 33 years. For the robbery in Las Vegas, there's a question as to whether or not people who commit extraordinarily horrific crimes should be continue to be honored for their accomplishments on the field of play. O.J. Simpson is one, Ray Lewis is another. Now, I'm not going to compare the two directly because their crimes were different. When Ray Lewis pleads guilty to obstruction of justice in a murder trial, a double murder, when he pleads guilty to obstructing justice, when he leaves an Atlanta nightclub, his white suit covered in murder victim's blood, a suit that then disappears, is never seen again, it's pretty clear that he either was complicit in or knew who was complicit in, since he was so close to it, he got bloody, the double murder of two innocent people. That's different than O.J. Simpson, who caused the double murder of two innocent people, because he very clearly did, and was held responsible for that in a civil trial. I kind of have to ask whether or not you have any problem with people like this being recognized in the all-time halls of fame. Nobody can dispute the performance of Ray Lewis and his contributions to championships. Nobody can dispute the performance of O.J. Simpson. But yet their contributions are offset by what they have taken away in a much bigger sense from their sport, from their teams, from their personality, from the league, and obviously from society and our culture because of their behavior in given situations. Do you have any problem with first ballot Hall of Fame status for Ray Lewis? Do you have any problems with first ballot Hall of Fame status for people who have been, let's just say, less than positive influences in the communities and in the league outside of their phenomenal individual statistical performances? That's, I guess, the only question. So congratulations to first ballot Hall of Famers Ray Lewis and Brian Urlacher, first ballot Hall of Famer Randy Moss, third ballot Hall of Famer Terrell Owens, and all of the others who waited such a long time, Robert Brazil, Jerry Kramer, Bobby Bethard. But I just, I've got a little bit of a question there. It's a conversation that I think that's worth having. Whether it's on the air, off the air, on Twitter, Facebook, or just around your dinner table, those are conversations that I think really are worth having. All right, so as I said, I wanted to get into a few other things non-Super Bowl related, including that one, including the Cavaliers train wreck. Kush, I cut you off because I wanted to get to those other ones real quick. Just on the Cavaliers, because I know we got our bottom of the hour local sports center before we have room, or make room, I should say, for Paul Keels. But real quick, Ty Lue is at the helm of a team that is simply atrocious. Ty Lue was handpicked by LeBron James to be, it is widely believed, according to many sources close to the Cavaliers, to be that coach. The team plays no defense. It does not show up most nights as if they just don't care at all whether they win or lose, which is a reflection of the coach. He has not done much to change the lineup other than Jay Crowder going to the bench for a little while and starting out on the bench and then coming back into the games. Nothing is getting better. It's far more than just a 7 or 8 game January swoon, yep, which we have seen in years past. It looks like it's getting worse the closer we get to the All-Star break and the closer we get to the trade deadline. How does Ty Lue save his job, and what kind of move do you think they have to make at the deadline to even remain relevant? Forget about winning a championship. To remain relevant as a potential Eastern Conference Finals participant.
Well, for the first question, what does Ty Lue have to do? He has to somehow not care about his players' feelings. And by that I mean, he has to make tough decisions. Like, for example, IT to the bench and Jose Calderon back to the starting lineup. It's exactly the kind of move that would wreck the fragile little egos in that locker room. But too bad. This team actually played their best basketball when Calderon, of all people, was at the point. As for the team as a whole, and let's also remember, with all of this, all the reports are that the Cavs have no intention of firing Ty Lue during the season.
I know.
So let's
that's why I asked.
Right, right. That's just something I think that it's good for everybody to keep in mind. As for what type of move, you know, without Love, you can't trade him away or use him as one of the possible players in a deal. So, first and foremost, and I know this goes against what most reportedly in that front office are thinking, which is, doesn't matter how much it's sinking, we need to hang on to that Nets draft pick so we can have something in a post-LeBron era when he probably leaves this offseason. Now, you need to include that somehow, because you have to make some kind of bigger move. Some George Hill type of player on the periphery is simply not going to be enough. So you have to make some kind of bigger move, and I don't know what you do for that. I honestly don't know, because they're so limited in what they could trade away, especially with Love essentially off the table because of his injury. But internally, pre or post-trade, Lou's got to say, the heck with all your feelings, guys. Here's the lineups that work best, so guess what? We're going to use them. And if that means the worst clubhouse guy, I think, in the entire tenure since LeBron came back, Isaiah Thomas going to the bench in place of Jose Calderon, of all people, so be it. Something
Isaiah
radical
Thomas can
has
go
to
past
happen.
The bench and right down the tunnel and out to the back alley. As far
That's
as
a
I'm
separate
concerned.
Conversation, which I agree with. But in the interim, he at least needs to go sit on the bench and not start, because he's giving nothing to this team. Honestly, the biggest thing he's given to this team is helping make this already chaotic, drama-filled clubhouse that much more so.
Yeah, there's no question about that. But let me just say this real quick before we get to our bottom of the hour sports center. We talk college hoops. You just said Ty Lue needs to stop worrying about his players' feelings and just say this is what has to be done, and tell them, you know, I'm not going to be a player's coach here. I'm going to do what's right for the team to win. Wouldn't that just make him David Blatt? Isn't that exactly why LeBron James wanted his buddy Ty Lue, who's friendly and the guys all like? Nobody likes David Blatt. He doesn't care about our feelings. He doesn't care about our fun. He demands that we play defense. He's just not a guy that we like being around. We like being around Ty Lue. And now the direction from Jim Cushlin, and by the way, I agree with you, is, hey, Ty, stop being so much like Ty. Start being more like the guy that was fired right before you.
I hadn't thought of it in that context, but I guess that's what I'm saying.
Paul Keels talks Ohio State basketball coming up after the bottom of our Sports Center, which is next.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling right along, are we, on this post-Super Bowl Monday edition of the Extravaganza. Quite an offensive extravaganza in its own right last night. No defense played over. I just don't necessarily like football games quite like that, one way or the other. Let's get the thoughts on that just for a moment or two before we start talking about what Paul Keels is really here for, and that is to talk about the Ohio State Buckeyes, who continue to thrive in the first season of Coach Chris Holdman's. Paul Keels, thanks for the time this afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. How you doing, Bob?
I'm great. Hey, we'll talk about victories in a moment. A nice two-game bounce back after the Penn State loss for the Buckeyes. And, of course, we want to preview the big showdown with Purdue that's coming up in a couple of days. But did you get a chance to watch last night? And did you enjoy a game that featured over 1,100 total yards of offense, one punt, and one sack in the football game, Paul?
I did enjoy it. I did get a chance. I was at a gathering with a bunch of people, so I wasn't watching it intently like if I was sitting at home by myself on the couch. But I just enjoyed the back and forth, the fact that it was a competitive game. Yeah, I can see why, you know, what you were saying about the lack of defense, where that maybe would not sit well with some people. But, no, I mean, you know, what the stretch of time has been where there were a lot of Super Bowls that weren't very good games. But just the fact that it was competitive, I was myself hoping to see the Eagles win, plain and simply just because they've never won a Super Bowl.
Sure.
So I enjoyed it from that standpoint.
Yeah, and I kind of had that same mindset as far as the Eagles winning. I felt like it was a win-win situation for me, though, because I love history. And watching the Patriots do things that will never, ever, ever be duplicated is kind of a cool thing. That's a historical thing for me. But from the, you know, the emotional standpoint of watching Philadelphia win their first, that's true. But here's the thing, and I kind of likened it as I watched it to an NBA All-Star game. You know, where it's just, we're going to throw lobs down the court and dunk, and nobody's going to try to stop us. There were guys so wide open in the secondaries of both teams, with neither team putting pressure on the quarterback, that it was just like, almost like full court lobs. And it's just, you know, it's just taking turns scoring, almost arena football-like, without any resistance. And I felt like I was missing half the game.
I thought you were going to say that about arena football. And, yeah, I hear where you're coming from. I don't know, that didn't bother me as much, but I understand what you're saying. It was a matchup that I think had a lot of intrigue, a lot of its own additional individual stories. I think certainly when, you know, you heard the soundbite of Kelsey after the game, how emotional he got talking about everything. To see Malcolm Jenkins, a former Buckeye, you know, have a solitary moment with the Super Bowl trophy. I think there were just a lot of really neat things. And even though they lost, I think, there's still a great appreciation for what the Patriots have been, what they are, you know, what Belichick has done, what Brady has done, and how they continue to perform at a high level with different people, even though, you know, those two names remain the same.
Yeah, no question about it. That has been what's, you know, one of the most amazing things about their run, which may be at an end. Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. Tom Brady is definitely coming back. We'll see if the Patriots keep the core together with Bill Belichick as well. All right, enough about what those guys have done. Let's talk about what a guy like Kata Bates Diop has done. 35 points and 13 rebounds, an absolutely monster game for Kata Bates Diop in this win over Illinois. Buckeyes moving to 20-8 on the season, 11-1. What did you say, Kush, on the rankings, up to 14, I want to say?
Indeed.
Yeah, 14. So, my goodness, what a monster game for him. Tell us more about that win.
Well, and it was needed considering the fact that they, you know, were without Cam Williams, who suspended indefinitely. It really kind of gave him an oddball lineup at times. But, you know, just when we think we've seen Kata really be special, he shows us again a different level of it. And, you know, in recent games, the offense hasn't come necessarily early to Kata. And he's struggled a little bit shooting the ball from three-point range, but just the way he rebounds the basketball, the way he's able to get to passes that are thrown maybe a little too high. And that was some of the case yesterday based on the way that Illinois was playing defense. And, you know, Chris Holdman even talked before the game knowing this was going to be an oddball game just because of how hard Illinois works at making you uncomfortable. So, you know, to fall down by 15 or 16 points in the first half and then to hold Illinois scoreless for 10 minutes and 5 seconds at the end of the first half, you know, that was really kind of an amazing thing when you got to halftime to realize that defensively Ohio State had shut them out like that. And, you know, Cade just shows all of the different things he can do, scoring around the basket, shooting from outside, all the different positions that he can guard. You know, we are getting a chance to witness a truly special individual basketball season.
Let's go back to the stretch that you just talked about, the 10 minutes and 5 seconds of shutout basketball. I mean, how does you don't just go from red hot to ice cold. I suppose you don't, at least that fast, the way Illinois shooters did, without, you know, something being different. But you also, how do you flip the switch on defense from, you know, from giving up, you know, the kind of shooting percentages they were until clamping it down? I mean, it just doesn't seem to be, especially without a halftime adjustment. This was all within the first half. That is an amazing thing. To what do you attribute that?
I wish I could give you a good answer to that, Bob. Illinois at times has struggled shooting the ball. That's why they've, you know, only won 2 conference games. And what they did in the first 10 minutes, at one point they were shooting at 60%. So that was kind of the odd twist that had the game go the way it did from the very beginning. But, you know, I don't know if you want to say reality set in when it came to what they did offensively or couldn't do. You know, I think not only just Cade, but, you know, Andre Wesson, who got the start yesterday. The coaches have ranted and raved about him with what he's done in regard to things that don't show up in the stat sheet, the way he's played defense with his athleticism. I think certainly both this year and last, we saw what C.J. Jackson can do to really disrupt people defensively. I think that's also where Andrew Dockich has been a value to this basketball team. And, you know, Caleb Wesson has kind of started to assert himself defensively as well. So I wish I could give you a specific answer. I think it was just a combination of, you know, and Chris Holtman talks a lot about how they communicate on defense, how they're connected on defense. But, mm-hmm. but truly where Illinois' offensive liabilities really kind of eventually showed their head.
We're talking to Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. Buckeyes on a 2-game winning streak after their long winning streak was snapped by Penn State in advance of Purdue coming up on Wednesday. Jim Cushman's with us as well, Paul, as you know. And Jim, go ahead.
And you mentioned this a few moments ago, and I'm not sure if there's any more information, but is there anything you could tell us about what the violation of team rules that has gotten Cam Williams suspended indefinitely from the team for?
No, there isn't, Jim, and I guess what we're all kind of anxious, and we'll have our weekly radio show with Chris Holtman tonight, and hopefully we may learn a little more. We may not, but, you know, there was some thought that it may be multiple games, and so they may not have him going into the game tomorrow, Wednesday night at Purdue, which would be a big loss, mostly because of the fact, and Cam's not scoring the way he has at times in the past, but he's a three-point threat, and when he's on the court, people have to pay attention to him, and that usually creates opportunities for other people. And Cam has been playing defensively with his athleticism, the best defense he's played in his entire 5-year career. So, but unfortunately, no more light being shed on that. I know there's some reports that it could be anywhere from 3 to 5 games. But really unfortunate for a fifth-year senior in the midst of a very special season to have this happen.
Yeah, it really is a very special season. Let's talk a little bit more about this showdown now coming up on Wednesday. Purdue at 12-0, the Bucks at 11-1 in the conference. 23-2, 20-5 overall. Purdue third ranked. Obviously, Ohio State could just really jump in the rankings if they were able to take Purdue down on Wednesday. What's it going to take, based on what you've seen from the Boilermakers? And they've been very consistent all season long and very, very good. But of course, the Buckeyes are having that special time right now. What's it going to take for the Buckeyes to go to Purdue on the road and win there?
Probably shoot the lights out. Number one. Have Purdue have difficulty shooting the basketball, which they don't seem to have much of an indication that that'll happen. And maybe if Purdue gets some of their key players in foul trouble. Bob, watching them, and I watched the first half of their game from Saturday against Rutgers. This is a team that looks like they could easily be a Final Four team. They've got great size with not only Isaac Haas, but Harms, a backup 7-footer who comes off. They've got the ability to have great shooting with Vincent Edwards and Dakota Mathias, basically playing with 2-point guards, with Carson Edwards and P.J. Thompson, and role players who come in, whether it's Ryan Klein or Nojel Eastern, a freshman who's come in and given them some athleticism at one of their wing spots. They just seem to have a lot going. Think about this, Bob. They've lost 2 games. They both occurred in November, and they occurred in back-to-back days in a tournament in the Bahamas. Other than that, they've been unblemished. They've been in tough games. You know, they struggled to beat Rutgers by 2 on Saturday. They had their hands full a week ago with Indiana. but found a way to win the game. Michigan, I know, has given them some tough battles.
That's right.
And they've run people off the floor, too. So, you know, it just seems to be a complete basketball team.
It really is, and it's a showdown now for first place and supremacy in the Big Ten here as we get closer and closer to tournament time in the Big Ten tournament. And, Paul, if it's okay, I think Jim wants to ask you something about the Buckeye football team. Jim?
Sure.
Yeah, you know, it seems the New England Patriots defensive coordinator spot is a highly interesting position involving everything local because, of course, Matt Patricia is going to be the Lions head coach. Word is the presser for that will be Wednesday, which leaves an open spot. And reading reports today, and then reading conflicting reports, that Greg Schiano, the Buckeyes defensive coordinator, may be the one heading up to Foxborough for that job. There's also, as I mentioned, a second report that's saying he hasn't decided yet. Anything new on that? Can you tell us? And if he were to leave, how big of a loss is that for the Buckeyes?
Yeah, nothing new, Jim. I know that report kind of started coming out late last week, too, that might possibly happen. That would be a significant loss, although, you know, as we all know, Greg Schiano was set to become Tennessee's head coach a few months ago before that blew up. And, you know, Urban Meyer has always talked with high-profile assistants like that. He's hoping they can give him 2 years before they move on to their next step. You know, I think what would be significant is if he does leave, you couple that with the loss of Kerry Combs, who went to the Tennessee Titans, their cornerbacks coach and their special teams coordinator. So now, maybe some of that is helped by the fact that you have the additional defensive coach that has come in now, the young man from Washington State, Grinch. So, you know, I don't know where that might possibly come into play with all of it. But, you know, I think for Greg Schiano, who knows if a change of scenery is what he would like, what would be good for him based on what's happened. He certainly has had a great influence on what's happened in his 2 years with Ohio State. It would be a significant loss. But, you know, I think that if he has envisions of being a head coach again, probably making a move would be something you could understand why he would do it.
Yeah, it certainly would make sense given the circumstances and everything that happened with Tennessee, no question about it. But let's not use the word loss and the words Ohio State together. Let's talk about wins. Let's go Buckeyes, get a win in Lafayette on Wednesday and take control of the Big Ten. Unexpected, tremendous season that just rolls on, and hopefully next week we'll be talking about a couple more Buckeye victories. Paul Keels, thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure, fellas. Take care.
You got it. Have a good one. No more losses. They might lose a coach. They might lose a coordinator, but how about let's stay positive and Buckeye wins on the basketball court. Okay, that's it. That's all the time that we've got. Thanks for some great conversation. Thanks to Jim Cushlin. And guess what? Got a treat for you. Coming up next, it's Drive Time. Mike Miller is back in the big chair right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, so stay here for that. And we'll talk to you tomorrow on the next extravaganza right here on The Ticket.